Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 28th of August. First hour of our program today, we'll be talking about Syria. And here's some of the news that we've been following today. This comes from the cable, foreignpolicy.com, and they say last Wednesday, in the hours after the chemical attack east of Damascus, an official at the Syrian Ministry of Defense exchanged panicked phone calls with a leader of a chemical weapons unit demanding answers for a nerve agent strike that killed more than 1,000 people. Those conversations were overheard by U.S. intelligence services, and it's the major reason why American officials now say they are certain the attacks were the work of the Assad regime and why the U.S. military is likely to attack that regime in a matter of days. President Assad's forces have evacuated most personnel from Army and Security Command headquarters in central Damascus in preparation for a Western military strike. And news that the United Kingdom has put a suggested resolution to the five permanent members of the UN Security Council authorizing all necessary measures to protect civilians in Syria. It calls for military action against what Britain has termed Syria's unacceptable use of chemical weapons. So there's a great deal to talk about this hour. Our guest is Professor Stephen Zunis. He's a professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco, where he chairs the program in Middle Eastern Studies. He is considered one of the country's leading scholars of the U.S. Middle East policy and of strategic nonviolent action. He's the principal editor of Nonviolent Social Movements and the author of Tinderbox, U.S. Middle East Policy and the Roots of Terrorism. So if we are on the verge of a military strike, what do you think? Is it a wise thing for us to do? What would be the consequences? Is it necessary action? Does it indeed say that if we don't respond, the moral fiber and conscience of America will be damaged? Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page, if you'd like to leave a message there, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Professor Stephen Zunis, thank you for joining us once again. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Does it look to you entirely likely at this moment that there is going to be a military attack by the United States very soon?
It's looking increasingly like that indeed is what's going to happen. You know, whether it will be in the next couple days or next couple weeks remains to be seen, whether it will be unilateral action by the United States or perhaps being joined by one or two NATO allies. That's also a question. It appears it would be a relatively limited strike in the sense that we're not talking about ground troops, we're not talking about a sustained bombing campaign, but a series of strikes likely using Tomahawk missiles. These are cruise missiles launched from U.S. Navy aircraft from our carrier fleet in the eastern Mediterranean.
You have been quoted, interview with the Voice of America, as saying that there are limits to what the strikes can accomplish. That's obviously a crucial question in whether or not we have a strike. What would it accomplish?
That's one of the big questions, frankly. I think we will blow up some buildings, installations, and probably kill some people. But it's not going to make much of a difference in terms of the strategic balance of the Syrian civil war. Indeed, the administration has acknowledged that up front, that this is not about regime change or anything in a broader strategic sense. Then there raises the question, well, what about the chemical weapons? Well, you know, the danger of attacking chemical weapons stockpiles in that it would release those very nerve agents into the atmosphere. And there's some indication that the Syrian regime may have deliberately stored at least some of these stockpiles in crowded civilian areas as a kind of a deterrent. So what this probably means is going to be some bases, some government buildings, and the like. But in many ways, it would seem to do little in terms of little consequences militarily, and risk some fairly negative consequences politically.
So the reason we would do it would be to satisfy our conscience, to take some kind of action. These weapons cannot be used, should never be used. And this is our action to keep them from being used?
that essentially appears to be what the message is trying to be. Of course, that raises a number of questions because we've had close to 100,000 people killed, mostly civilians. Chemical weapons attack of earlier this week added a relatively small number of casualties to that total. The concern, of course, is that it was chemical weapons and that that is a very clear violation of international legal norms. But then the fact is that a unilateral military strike like this is also a violation of international legal norms.
You would have to, it's my understanding, correct me here if this is wrong, that in order, there is international law that says that military action must be taken after a decision by the Security Council. Great Britain has introduced such wording of an action, mm-hmm. but it's not likely to be approved by the Security Council, is it?
No, it's very likely to have a Russian and Chinese veto. Even though the British resolution would probably limit it to that of protecting civilian lives. The problem is that in the case of Libya, where the Russians and Chinese did accede to granting member states, and in this case NATO, the right to intervene in Libya, that was specifically for the purpose of enforcing a no-fly zone to protect civilians. And what happened, as we all know, is that the NATO went well beyond that mandate and essentially became the air force for the rebel army. As a result, there's been a lot of suspicion by the Russians and Chinese and others that if they did grant even limited mandates to protect civilians, it would be taken much further. And indeed, that may have been what motivated Russia and China to veto three previous UN Security Council resolutions, which were actually quite reasonable and quite moderate and did not imply military intervention.
Mm-hmm. Do you have, Joe Biden said, the vice president yesterday, there is no doubt who is responsible. Secretary of State Kerry has said pretty much the same thing. Do you have any doubts?
I'm 95% certain. I was initially skeptical, as were a lot of people, because it did seem so irrational. The UN inspectors had just arrived. The Syrian government had made some significant advances on the ground in recent months. I mean, one would certainly expect a regime this ruthless to use chemical weapons if their backs were against the wall, if the rebels were closing in on Damascus or something like that. But the timing seemed very odd. And while there have been no confirmed reports that the chemical weapons stockpiles have been raided or taken, there have been large scale defections by some fairly prominent officers in the Syrian armed forces. There have been some bases overrun, so there's a possibility that the rebels might have gotten hold of something. But the evidence more and more does appear to be that it was indeed an attack by the Syrian government, presumably to clear out a rebel stronghold close to the capital that was blocking a major road and had been a real headache for the Syrian government, despite their advances elsewhere. The problem, though, is that even though I'm 95% certain that it was indeed the Syrian government that was responsible, given the record of the United States in these matters, particularly regarding Iraq. Indeed, Joe Biden and John Kerry, as senators, that use very similar language, emphatic, categorical language, in claiming that Iraq still had chemical weapons as well as biological weapons delivery systems, nuclear program, et cetera, that we all know now was suspected at the time was not true. So, unfortunately, the legacy of Iraq has given the United States a little credibility in this regard. And so, no matter how solid the evidence, there are going to be a lot of people, both home and abroad, who are going to doubt this, and it's spawning already all sorts of conspiratorial allegations.
Right. So why wouldn't you? Why a rush here? The UN yesterday was saying they needed quite a bit more time. Today we're hearing that the weapons inspectors need 4 days to confirm this and to give their findings to proper authorities. What's the rush? Why wouldn't you wait for the UN to let us know what they found?
It really would seem to make a lot of sense to do that, because, again, we're not, given that, again, these respective attacks would not shift the strategic balance, it would be more to send a political message. We don't want that to get muddied, by doubts about the accuracy of the report and therefore the motivations for such a strike.
Mm-hmm. So let's say that you do the military strikes. They are somewhat successful. You've taken out some important communication lines and some military headquarters, but you're not doing a regime change. So you're hoping for what? The Syrian government will admit they've used these and we're going to destroy them and they'll never be used again? Or is there a game plan?
Not one that I can figure out. I mean, there's and indeed the concern here that I have is not that I'm against the idea of humanitarian intervention in principle. I think, for example, in Rwanda in 1994, it would have been nice if there had been intervention earlier and the like. But the problem is multiple. One is that history has shown that foreign military intervention in civil wars against repressive regimes tends to, even for humanitarian causes, tends to actually increase the amount of deaths and the lengths of the war, in large part because the regime figures it has nothing to lose and escalates the violence even more, has a kind of gloves-off mentality. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, the rebels feel, hey, we got these great powers at our back, we don't need to negotiate, we don't need to compromise. And this is particularly true, I think, in a situation like Syria, because one of the big problems with Syria is that despite all the horrible, horrible things the Assad regime has done, through a combination of the divide and rule with the religious minorities, the fact that it's more of an oligarchy than one man rules. Assad is not like Gaddafi or Mubarak. I mean, he's part of a vast apparatus that has ruled Syria for the better part of 50 years, the Ba'ath Party and the military. That and most importantly, because he has skillfully played the nationalist card. You know, Syria sees itself as the last of the great secular Arab nationalist governments that opposes both Islamic extremism and Western imperialism, and that's why they are supposedly being targeted. And U.S. bombing, unfortunately, would play right into that narrative and increase his support, because, again, despite everything, the regime has a support of the good one-third of the population. I mean, this is a genuine civil war. This is not a revolution against somebody like Gaddafi, who has virtually no support and is hanging on by his fingernails.
Mm-hmm. There have been concerns about how other countries in the area would be affected. Israel evidently putting its missile defense systems on high alert, worried that they might see some retaliatory action from Iran or from Syria or from Hezbollah. Is that reasonable on their part?
I'm not sure that Israel per se would be targeted, but it does raise a broader question that given that the United States would not be targeted, given the distance and our defenses and that kind of thing, we could see Syria and its allies lashing out. Israel would be a logical, I wouldn't say logical, but a target that would come to mind, certainly. And also, it raises the risk, for example, that the Iranians, might up the ante by bringing in ground troops, the Revolutionary Guard, to join the fight, and that's a real problem when you have a military intervention like this, is that that the other side will try to find a way to up the ante, to escalate. And it could indeed lead to a spiraling escalation that may or may not involve Israel, but would certainly end up getting even more people killed.
Some people have talked about Egypt's security forces in the last few weeks slaughtering hundreds of Egyptians who have been protesting the military coup, shooting them to kill them above the waist in the head. Is there something, and you also, as you said, if you're doing a military strike, if the U.S., it would seem to me as though it's hard to be so accurate that you wouldn't kill any civilians. Is there something worse about the death from chemical agents? Is there some reason that this has been singled out rather than other kinds of deaths that come from military action?
Well, chemical weapons have been illegal since the 1920s in an international treaty that came together after the horror of World War One. And despite even greater horror of World War II, that ban largely stayed. There were some exceptions, actually mostly in the Middle East. The British used chemical weapons when they conquered Iraq in the 1920s, following the fall of the Ottomans. The Egyptians used it in Egypt during their intervention in Yemen civil war in the early 1960s. And, of course, Saddam Hussein using it on a massive scale against both Iranian troops and Kurdish civilians. In terms of somewhat bad timing, I suppose, the United States, that some declassified documents came out confirming what I and other people had written about previously, that is, the United States Defense Intelligence Agency, this is part of the Pentagon, was in Baghdad using U.S. satellite footage to help the Iraqis target concentrations of Iranian forces in the full knowledge that they were using chemical weapons. And, in fact, the components for Iraq's chemical weapons arsenal came from shipments of pesticides and fertilizer from the United States as part of a foreign aid package. And congressional hearings in the early 90s showed that Reagan administration officials knew that they were being converted to chemical weapons, but kept the shipments going anyway. And so even on the chemical weapons question, the U.S., unfortunately, has not been very consistent.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655 is our number, and our guest is Professor Stephen Zunis, Professor of Politics, International Studies at the University of San Francisco. We're talking about what would appear to be U.S. strike against Syria that may happen within the next few days. The UN is still investigating the use of chemical agents and would have yet to give a report. They're asking for a delay in any kind of action. Polls are showing that the American public are not very much in favor of this. What do you think about it? Do we have to take a moral stand against the use of such weapons? Do you think such a strike could be effective? What would you see as an end game? How would you have to be convinced for military action to take place? Or do you believe that it's something that we should just stay out of? It's a civil war, and we shouldn't be there at all. We welcome your phone calls. We'll take them momentarily. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Phone calls now for Professor Stephen Zunis. What is the correct course of action to let Syria know if indeed there is definitive information that chemical agents have been used? What's the best response to keep those from ever being used again? Let's go to Phil first in Hebron, Illinois. Hi, Phil.
Hi. I got two quick ones for you. Seeing as we've done nothing up to now, what is the downside of doing absolutely nothing? And as far as Syria having chemical weapons, we know Al-Qaeda is involved on the side of the Syrian regime. Couldn't Al-Qaeda just put a nice chemical weapon on an airplane and fly it to New York City? They don't really need a missile, do they?
Well, the Al-Qaeda has been trying to get a hold of non-conventional weapons for quite a while, and fortunately, as far as we know, so far they have not. I don't think they could fly to the United States due to our air defenses and the like. But and one of the big risks, in fact, the biggest risk, I think, of the whole chemical weapons issue is, at least in terms of U.S. Policy planners, has not been the regime's use of these weapons against civilians, but the fact that an Al-Qaeda-related group might overrun a Syrian facility that stockpiles these weapons. Again, there's no evidence that has happened thus far. I mean, the rebels are a diverse lot. You know, the Al-Qaeda represents only a small minority, less than 10%, but they are, and that was about the same percentage they were in Iraq, and as we know, they were able to do a disproportionate amount of damage in the course of that country's bloody conflict, which is still going on a somewhat reduced level today. And I'm sorry, I forgot the first question.
What happens from doing nothing? What's the downside of doing nothing?
If there was a the quick answer is that the slaughter would just continue. But unfortunately, I think if there's no guarantee that if the United States did intervene militarily or increase our arms to the rebels, that it would do anything to reduce it. And again, as I said at the outset, if I really did think that military intervention would reduce the amount of killing, would make more likely the prospects of a stable and democratic Syria, I would support it. But I really, every scenario I look at, I just really don't see that as happening.
Thanks, Phil. Let's go to John in La Crosse. Hi, John.
Hi, how you doing?
All right, how are you?
Good. My question for the guest today was his opinion on why we haven't pursued some kind of like judicial measures instead of military action. I mean, I don't know that we should think of Iraq as a positive example, but at the end of the day there, we ended up putting Saddam on trial, and his own people found him guilty of war crimes, that kind of thing. Why haven't we talked about taking Assad to The Hague, and trying him for war crimes if using chemical weapons is illegal?
Mm-hmm. I think certainly that's a... there'd be a very strong case for Assad and his top leaders to face war crimes charges, not just for the chemical weapons, but for the large-scale killings of civilians that's been going on for quite some time. And I imagine there are actually investigations. They are moving forward on that in The Hague. It's not up to the United States or any single government, really, to do that, but... It would certainly make a very strong case. The problem, of course, is extraditing them. There are quite a number of countries that have people who have been indicted, including national leaders, who are under indictment but aren't being extradited because the country refuses to extradite them. So there's that angle. But I think, if they're if the government is ever brought down, I assume that there will certainly be members, surviving members of the regime who will have to face justice.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's hard to imagine if the government is brought down, what would replace it, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a big question. The initial resistance to the Assad regime, which began in March of 2011, was a broad-based, non-sectarian, democratic, nonviolent pro-democracy movement, and I personally know a number of people who were involved in that. I study these kinds of pro-democracy, nonviolent struggles around the world. It was very much in the tradition of what we've seen from the Philippines to Poland, from Chile to Serbia, and more recently in North Africa. But unfortunately. Civil society was weaker in Syria than in Tunisia and Egypt. And it was less strategic. It was a more spontaneous kind of uprising. And as I mentioned earlier, the regime did have a stronger base of support. And so as the repression increased, there were defections from the armed forces by those who refused to shoot in the crowds of unarmed protesters. And unfortunately, many of them brought their guns and, along with armed civilians, started fighting, which unfortunately gave the regime the excuse to crack down even more. Mm. And despite the rationalization, says, we need to take up arms to protect the civilians, the rate of civilian casualties has gone up tenfold since the launching of the armed struggle. It's played the regime at its strongest point, and it has led to the emergence of the extremist groups. I mean, we have Free Syrian, not only do you have Al-Qaeda and the very dangerous radical Salafi Sunni armed groups, but even within the Free Syrian Army, the Pentagon estimates there are at least 1,000 separate militias.
Oh my goodness.
Within the Free Syrian Army, it does not have a central command. Some of them are as crazy and extreme as the Al-Qaeda types, there's very little coordination, and that's why there's some serious questions even about the idea of arming the rebels. So who do you arm? A shoulder-fired missile launcher might protect a village from being attacked by a Syrian helicopter gunship. That same missile launcher could shoot down a civilian airliner. There's idea. Well, the people have talked about, oh, we can arm the moderates, but how do you distinguish in such a chaotic situation where you have these militia that, in some cases, that we've seen in northeastern Syria recently, they start fighting each other.
Have we been able to distinguish? Is there a group that we say, hey, you'd be all right?
There are some figures, especially in exile, that have been trying to coordinate things that the U.S. trusts mostly, and I don't want to in any way imply that the majority of people who are fighting the regime are Islamist extremists. And indeed, they're caught in the middle sometimes, and we don't hear about it as much. There is still a civil insurrection. There is still a nonviolent resistance going on, though at a much lesser pace, of course, than it was before the serious fighting started. So the fact is, it is a very a dicey situation in terms of who we support. If you look at Afghanistan, which many people saw that as a justifiable case of arming opposition in the face of the Soviet invasion, the brutality of the puppet communist government that they installed, and all that, the 80% of U.S. arms to the Mujahideen went into the hands of the Hezbollah Islami, the Hekmakdiar faction, the most extremist of the half dozen or so Mujahideen groups, a group that is now currently allied with the Taliban and fighting American forces.
Oh, goodness. We're welcoming phone calls. We're talking about Syria this hour and asking if you believe that the United States is about to strike Syria. Do you think that that is important just on a the right thing to do kind of basis? What would you hope would be accomplished? Should we hold back until the UN investigation is complete and it's proven? Or should we do absolutely nothing and let a civil war there continue? Here's our phone number. Lines are open for you right now, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our guest expert is Professor Stephen Zunis. He's a professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco, written extensively about the Middle East, and has met with top government officials, academics, journalists, and opposition leaders in many countries in the Middle East. And we're getting your thoughts about an action that would appear, according to rhetoric from top administration officials, to be imminent. Can you tell me a little bit more about, because I've read different things that they've said, and I don't know if there's one clear message coming from the Arab League. Can you tell us who are the members of the Arab League and what statement they made yesterday?
Well, the Arab League is composed of the 22 of the Arab countries. They have never held Assad or his father in high esteem, to put it mildly. Syria was the only country to side with Iran during the Iran-Iraq war. As I mentioned, his secular Arab nationalism is at odds, with the monarchies and the more conservative governments that tend to dominate. And a number of the Arab League countries, including especially Qatar and Saudi Arabia, have been arming the rebels. At the same time, they have they've expressed serious reservations about a U.S. attack against Syria, presumably for reasons, as I outlined earlier, that they're afraid of a nationalist reaction, and that whatever military damage it may do, it would actually end up politically strengthening the regime.
Let's talk just a little bit more about chemical weapons. They've been banned, as you said, for a long period of time. Who's manufacturing these right now, and how many countries have these weapons? Why are they still in existence?
Well, their use has been banned for close to 90 years now. But in more recent years, there has been an effort to totally eliminate chemical weapons under United Nations organization, and they've had remarkable successes under a Brazilian diplomat who headed it for quite a few years. They expanded the treaty until it now is now made up of all but 8 countries in the world. And all the signatories have either physically eliminated their chemical weapons or pledged not to use them or are in the process of eliminating them. The 8 holdouts include Syria, Israel, and Egypt. The problem with U.S. policy, unfortunately, is that we've tended to focus only on Syria in this regard. Indeed, there were some sanctions imposed on Syria back in 2003 for their refusal to sign on to the treaty while saying nothing about the U.S. allies. Mm-hmm. Syria responded by saying, we will sign on, eliminate our weapons if we can get all the other Middle Eastern countries to agree as well. But the U.S. rejected that. In fact, the Bush administration threatened to veto a draft Security Council resolution in 2007 that would call for a universal ban of weapons of mass destruction in the greater Middle East, as it was actually initially called for in U.N. Resolution 687, the Iraqi disarmament resolution, which explicitly said that Iraq's the disarmament of its weapons of mass destruction would be the first step of a region-wide disarmament plan. And so this more unilateral approach, the United States kind of rejecting the more universalist thing, has enabled Syria, again, playing the nationalist card to say, well, if these U.S. allies like Israel and Egypt can hold on to their chemical weapons, why can't we?
Mm-hmm. And I'm having a hard time understanding why anybody, well, I have a hard time understanding this whole business of war, but why would you use chemical agents? Why?
In part, is to they're efficient. They kill a lot of people. You don't have to have a pinpoint surgical strike that covers a wide area. And indeed, this attack apparently did kill quite a few rebel soldiers who were the primary target of the attack, apparently. But of course, it had killed many hundreds of civilians as well. And this may be part of the plan as well, frankly, to terrify people. War in being bombed is and being in the midst of a war is a pretty horrifying experience anyway. But when you can't breathe, when everybody around you is dying, and you're going through these incredible pain, and your innards are turning inside out. It is a particularly horrific, horrific, painful death, and that is part of the idea, frankly, is to terrify people into submission.
Mm. Adrian sends an email. By what authority can the president order a military attack on a sovereign nation absent a declaration of war by Congress, a UN resolution, or an imminent threat to this country? Is a missile attack on Syria not a violation of international law? Here we go again.
Yeah, well, the United States has not formally declared war since Pearl Harbor. Many of our military actions, including the Gulf War and the invasion of Iraq, were authorized by Congress. The former being legal because it was authorized by the United Nations Security Council, the latter being illegal. But so they're both the constitutional questions and the international law questions. The international law is very clear that you can only use military force if authorized by the UN Security Council, or if you are directly attacked, which in neither case, of course, is fits here. And there's something in customary international law that says you can do a preemptive attack, but that's only if you, for example, have troops massing on the border about to invade. You actually see an enemy putting missiles into the launcher that are about to attack you. So by any definition, a U.S. Attack on Syria would be a violation of international law. The other question, of course, is our own Constitution, that the U.S. Constitution, as well as the War Powers Act, limits what the president can do unilaterally. Again, if the United States is attacked directly, doesn't have to wait until Congress convenes to give him the right as commander in chief to take the necessary actions in self defense. But Barack Obama, when he was running for president in 2007, specifically said that his understanding of the Constitution, and of course he was a professor of constitutional law at the University of Chicago prior to his political career. He said that he would oppose military force unless there is an actual or imminent threat to the nation. That president has no authority unless there is an actual or imminent threat to the nation. However, yesterday, White House spokesman Jay Carney said that Syria's use of chemical weapons constitutes a threat to the United States' national security, and implied very strongly that Obama could go ahead and order these strikes without congressional approval. Needless to say, this is a fairly controversial position in the eyes of constitutional scholars, but that seems to be the position the White House is taking.
Well, that's interesting, considering the fact, as you just said, that he's a constitutional scholar.
Exactly.
Yeah. He also said, some are saying that he sort of boxed himself in here. I don't know if that's the case. It seems like an easy answer here. But he did say last year that chemical weapons use in Syria would cross that red line. Do you know why he said that?
Apparently, it was a response to a question. It was kind of off the cuff. It was not something that had been thought through. And he probably regrets having said that, frankly. Because in certain ways it does box him into a corner, at least in terms of some of his more hawkish opponents, pushing him to say, oh, now U.S. credibility is at stake and the like. Clearly, if the decision needs to be based on what he thinks is best, not on political posturing.
We welcome more of your phone calls. We're talking about Syria this hour of the program, indications from rhetoric from the vice president and from the secretary of state are that the United States is very seriously considering military action against Syria for their use of chemical weapons. Those weapons, the UN is determining right now through, as you know, the people who are there, how they were used, what kinds of weapons were used, and they're saying they needed another 4 days. Britain has put together and given to the Security Council a resolution calling for action because of the use of chemical weapons. That's not likely to get passed by the Security Council because Russia and China wouldn't go along with that. So the United States could take kind of a unilateral action. What do you think about all of this? Is it something that needs to be done because when it comes to warfare, this is crossing the line, and the international community said a long time ago, you simply can't use these kinds of weapons, and so there needs to be some kind of retaliation. Is it indeed a civil war in Syria that needs to be handled in Syria with no outside intervention? What do you think? The U.S. could be taking a fairly dramatic action in the next few days. Would you support it? Is there some evidence that would make you support it? Would you never support it? Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls, 800-486-8655. Professor Stephen Zunis, a professor of Middle East Studies at the University of San Francisco, is our guest. And Bob in Greenfield is our next caller. Hi, Bob.
Hello. I agree with taking some action. I think the whole region is at stake. The longer they wait, I realize that, this is on the premise of, like, Obama getting put into a corner by making this statement about chemical weapons, but there's been problems where people have been firing into Turkey from Syria. You've got I think more school age kids in Lebanon from Syria. I think the whole region's at risk, and I think as long as he can get a coalition with, say, like France and Britain, and even though I wouldn't want to say that, I think they will. So there will be some troops in there. It might be a coalition, but I think they're going to put troops in there.
Professor Zunis?
One of the many tragedies that's unfolded since this nonviolent pro-democracy movement descended into this chaotic war is that it's become kind of a proxy conflict. So you have the Saudis and Qataris and others supporting some of the Islamist militias. You have Turkey bringing in arms and support and logistics. You have Hezbollah and Iran supporting the government. And my concern, of course, is to have the U.S. involved. It's just going to end up getting more people killed, and it's going to. And the more we internationalize the conflict, the more the risk of it spreading to other countries, and it'll have the opposite effect.
Let's go to Dwight in Duluth. Hi, Dwight.
Hello.
Yeah, I'm thinking that we need to stay out of this thing. This is, you know, they're talking about the 1,000-year war. So if we get involved, okay, we're just going to get another side pitted against us because it didn't go with them. And how we're going to change anything is we're just going to have more of that society mad at us. And I am ready for the Arab nation to start policing themselves. This is Muslims doing it against Muslims. Why do we need to spend any of our money over there on that?
Stephen.
Yeah. I mean, I do believe on one level that, you know, the United States, given our power and influence, you know, can be a force of good in the world. I just don't think that and I really would like to see us, you know, putting in aid to support the refugees and humanitarian efforts and, you know, where appropriate, and, you know, perhaps, you know, some assistance to the democratic, what remains the democratic nonviolent movement. But again, the you know, putting the military side is not a good one. Again, especially given our history, the fact that unfortunately the United States, despite our professed democratic values and our you know, political our freedoms and democratic institutions here at home, we're the world's number one supporter diplomatically and militarily and economically of dictatorships around the globe, especially in the Middle East. And so, again, this is another thing that, frankly, hurts our credibility if we, even in situations where we want to try to do the right thing.
How many refugees, Syrian refugees, are there now, and where are they?
The estimates, you know, vary, but we're getting up to, you know, 2 or 3 million.
Oh my goodness!
And yeah, it's just huge, and it's they are largest number are in Turkey or in refugee camps, kind of right on the border there. Fair number have fled into Lebanon and to Jordan. And just to give an idea of how bad things are, you're having a huge refugee flow into Iraq. And, you know, when Iraq seems to be a safer place than your country, you know, things have gotten pretty bad.
Right. Kay on Facebook says, limited airstrikes that most likely won't accomplish anything but sow further seeds of anger against the U.S. This retaliation to chemical weapons being used sounds a lot like a false flag operation, like the Lewinsky distraction where we bombed a pharmaceutical plant in Sudan during the Clinton era.
The bombing of the pharmaceutical plant, I think, was more a thing of bad intelligence, thinking it was a chemical weapons plant. But unfortunately, that had serious consequences, not only denying Syrians badly needed antibiotics and vaccines, which led to quite a number of deaths, but it led the Sudanese government, which had been collaborating with us on tracking down al-Qaeda, to turn against us. But it's an example, though. Again, I don't see it as a false flag thing per se. I think it was definitely a lesson of the unintended consequences of taking a military action.
Pat and Rudolph, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure, Pat.
My call is about the comment about whether or not this intervention would be against international law. Well, we are the enforcers of international law. I'm not sure who else would do it. And we are considering the intervention because the use of chemical agents is a violation, a serious violation of international law. Mm-hmm. And I think that the other Arab nations that are our allies have been supplying the opposition forces in Syria. Mm-hmm.
Yes, they have, and though I think the very fact that the allies have been supporting them, particularly Saudi Arabia and Qatar, being repressive authoritarian regimes, especially Saudi Arabia, raises a question whether their goal is a more democratic, law-based Syria, or whether they are trying to impose their, you know, hardline fundamentalist kind of agenda. My concern is that, you know, the United States does have a lot of power to do good. The fact that that the United States has such a poor record in terms of international law, such as with the invasion of Iraq, the fact that we are among a few holdout nations in a number of prominent human rights treaties, including that banning landmines and cluster bombs and the like. In fact, we just announced a large sale of many millions of dollars of cluster bombs to the Saudis. We're really, unfortunately, not in a position to do this. And furthermore, we've not been designated that kind of role. International law is, by its nature, an international phenomenon turned by the United Nations, the World Court, and the like. So it's not, people, you say, well, we need to be the international policeman because nobody else is playing the police role. Unfortunately, the reality would be more like the international vigilante, that makes its own decisions about, what laws we can support, which laws we can't, and who does what, depending on their relationships and political ideological concerns. And I think as long as that is the orientation, we really don't have the moral or legal authority to do so.
Pat, thank you. Anne in Oshkosh, hi.
Hello. I'm calling because I would like to bring up a subject that seems to be unspoken, and that is the fact that the Israelis have, in fact, used chemical weapons against the Palestinians in the past. They were not lethal, but they were debilitating. And they stand to gain from perpetual chaos in the countries around them, and they are able to attack Lebanon or Syria or Iraq or Egypt or the Sinai with impunity. And so is it possible that nobody dare mention that perhaps the Israelis may be involved in keeping a lot of this tension going, and some of these false flag type things may be due to their intervention?
I've been very critical of the many Israeli policies, including the use of CS gas and crowd control in crowded areas, which at times has actually been lethal, especially to infants and elderly, as well as the use of phosphorus bombs and Gaza and Lebanon and elsewhere, which also bring up serious moral and legal questions. But I really strongly object to this implication that Israel is somehow behind the chaos. Obviously, any power, any government in the area, especially one that has the unique strategic concerns of Israel, will try to take advantage of certain situations for their own benefit. But what's happening in Syria is that of Syrians. In fact, the Israelis, as much as they've despised the Assad regime, frankly, would are probably a lot more nervous about some of the rebel groups that could get a big foothold in Syria and attack them. In fact, one thing a lot of people forget was that in 2007, Assad sued for peace with Israel. He said, give us back the Golan Heights, which you've occupied since 1967, and we'll have full diplomatic relations, full economic relations, security guarantees, demilitarize the Golan, bring in international peacekeepers, whatever. And the Israeli cabinet was seriously considering it, but the Bush administration basically told the Israelis, don't do it because it will give Assad a political victory, and we're trying to isolate and get Assad and get rid of the guy. So and Shimon Peres, the Israeli president, acknowledged it was pressure from the Bush administration that led the cabinet to reject that proposal. Now we have a more right-wing government in Israel, which is on its own has no interest in making peace. But this idea that the Israelis are trying to get rid of Assad because he's such a big threat, even if it leads to the rise of these extremist organizations, I really don't see any logic to that.
And finally, we have about 45 seconds left. Christy, on email, I would imagine you'd agree with this. Our history is full of civil wars in which we've intervened with unintended consequences. The use of chemical weapons is tragic. We are not prepared to consider Syria truly crucial to our national security and fully intervene. The administration has not articulated a goal and contingencies for unexpected outcomes. Without a UN resolution, we should not intervene.
I very much agree with that. I mean, I think there's this kind of American spirit we have that we if we try something hard enough or put in enough of money or arms or effort, we can get things done. And there's something very admirable about that spirit, of course. But I think in the case of complicated foreign wars like this, it's not something we should try.
Thank you very much for being with us again, Professor Zunis. It'll be interesting to see what happens the next couple days.
Thank you.
Professor Stephen Zunis, our guest He's been with us before. He's a professor of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of San Francisco. He's written widely about that part of the world and, as you heard him say, has traveled frequently and studies democracy movements in the Middle East. We thank him for his time. And I'm sure we'll be doing more stories on this as the days proceed. Thanks very much to K.P. Whaley and Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. Thanks for all of your contributions. Please stay with us. We have a really interesting hour coming up, and we invite you to join us.